Have you ever had the suspicion that your life consists largely of booted ground balls, bad throws to first, and occasionally being picked off of second base, and once in a while a good, long, solid, foul ball that rises higher and higher and higher out over that upper deck and into the street, a blast of 475 feet. Foul. Oh, the other day I'm out at the Mets ball game. You know, I think the thing that makes baseball the perfect thing that it is the fact that it truly is, a kind of amalgam of all the human frustrations. I'm sitting back at third base, see, and I see this third baseman for the Philadelphia Phils, and let me tell you, it's far more enlightening to go see the Phils and the Mets play baseball than it ever is to see the New York Yankees and the Detroit Tigers play. Let me tell you, for a very good reason, too. Because you see all the frailties, all the hopes, the desires, and the beautiful moments of instantaneous victory to be followed only by the inevitable. Like there was this Philadelphia Phils third baseman named Don Demeter. Good ball player, see? He's standing there moving like a cat back and forth around third base. Moving like a cat. Watch that third baseman. He moves easy and clean. Pow! Hard hit ground ball off to his left. He dives in the dirt, comes up with it, and throws it in the upper deck. That throw was 45 feet wide at first base. And the New York Met player, in spite of the fact that he was one of the slowest ball players in the league, got to third base on what should have been an easy out without even breathing hard. And there was this instant realization that the scoop, the move, the push, and all the rest of it is all part of it and never will ever be separated from it. And then and then there was this majestic sight that I think is part of our time more probably than even the ball team, the Mets themselves. I'm sitting out there and I notice back of third base, in a magnificent position. I mean, one of the really expensive boxes, right down on the field, a true ringside box, right back of the dugout. Now, the dugout, the third base dugout, of course, is this is considered one of the better areas to watch a ball game from, as well as, of course, being a part of the home team, the whole business. See? So right back, third base, there's this box right on the field. Now get the picture. There's 10,000 wildly screaming, defeated fanatics out there hollering. And I notice down there in the box, there are four people. There is a very chic girl type with a large, floppy picture hat. And I cannot tell you how interesting a picture hat looks at a ball game, especially in the polo grounds with those currents. And she's sitting out there with her picture hat on, and she's got this look, you know, the New York Times Sunday supplement look. A little thing with a hair brushed down over the eyes, and above it says betrothed. And then she's sitting there, and smoking a cigarette from a holder. And next to her is one of these large, square-jawed, slightly tousled blonde types, you know. And I'm sitting there, he'd run some wild, he'd laugh, with a very horsey kind of laugh. And he's chuckling over what's going on in the ballpark. And sitting next to him is a slightly older man of the clipped, silver-gray mustache type. And then there was a vacant seat in their box. And then the box over on the end, that seat right on the end there of the box, the vacant seat was in between them. And on the other end there was sitting their chauffeur. He's sitting there watching the ball game, discreetly removed from the marster, and nevertheless watching the same ball game. And the idea of three people out at the Mets ball game with their chauffeur sitting discreetly one seat removed, somehow brings it all into focus. Now, I couldn't tell who was more involved in the ball game, the chauffeur or the people who were there. I'm inclined to believe that none of them were. The chauffeur was very politely observing the proceedings. And you see, one thing, the etiquette of a chauffeur at a ball game, sitting in the box of the marster, is a very demanding kind of etiquette, I'm sure. Now, I don't suppose at any one given point did he have the guts to jump up on his seat and bellow, you know, and belt it out, you know. Start the, you know, shake, you know what happens in ball games. On the other hand, you see, he had to maintain a certain decorum, because I'm not sure whether you're allowed to really enjoy something. Now, when I came to the ball game, I noticed an enormous silver-gray Rolls Royce parked in a very official place out there in front of the ballpark. I thought, well, things are happening out here at the Polo Grounds, and it's all part of the same scheme. You're never going to get away from it, and yet. On the other hand, I'm wondering, because I'm sitting next to a guy out at the ballpark, and I notice a chick back of us. You know what's you know what's being attracted to the Mets? I wonder how many people have noticed this. There's a large group of people who are, in the sense, the best sense in a way, and yet in, so probably in the funniest sense, a large group of people who are intellectual underdogs. You know, inveterate post readers. You know what I mean? People who vaguely feel that they can mix intellect and sex. On one page they get Murray Kempton, and on the next page they get the place where they raided the Alderman's love nest. You know, in seven fantastic photographs, and the crash photos come right after that. Then after that you get a searching analysis of our trade relationships with Peru, and how our racial discrimination is affecting them. This is a nice balance, you see, of the insane and the idiotic, once in a while quietly touching upon what appears to be the surface of reality, hardly ever going below that. And then there's the 14-part article on how wonderful Harry Belafonte is. That always shows up in the Post about every 2 weeks. So here you've got this whole thing going on there, and I'm curious about the people that are going out there, because most of them don't seem to be much more interested in, more, I'd say tepidly interested in baseball, actually. Because right behind me, and about four seats off to the right, was sitting a girl who, through the entire first game, read, and I'm not exaggerating, it was right there. This chick sat for the entire first game, directly behind me, four seats to my right, back of third base. She read the New York Times book review supplement. Did not even bother to look up during even the wildest of misplays and miscues and home runs and fist fights and everything else that was breaking out. She was deeply involved in an analysis of Edmund Wilson's new book on the Civil War. And once in a while she would look up to accept daintily a hot dog tendered by her swain or whatever he was. And it's a fascinating, yeah, that was interesting too. And I mean, it's all a picture, you know, it has nothing to do with baseball. And over off to the right, there was another guy sitting next to me, you see, and he was the totally incommunicative type. It's like as if you found Holden Caulfield 10 years afterwards, and now he's married to this chick, you see, and he's taking her to the ball game, and he's trying to tell her about baseball. And he's very incommunicative about that. And then he figured I was trying to make out with her, on top of everything else, because once in a while I'd make a comment about the baseball game. So we're sitting there, and once in a while he would turn to me and he says, "This is a very loud crowd. I suspect that they're even louder here than they are at the Yankee Stadium." And I said, "That is true." And for some reason or other, he was hung up on trying to see what Houston was doing. And once in a while he would look out at the scoreboard to see what Houston was doing, but mostly he would sort of float halfway up in the middle distance somewhere, above the field, and off, I'd say a little bit to the right of third base is where his gaze was. And this went on quietly all afternoon. Then I moved back around, back around home base, and there is an interesting crew that sits way up in the back in the dark bleachers that reach all the way up to the hot dog stand, almost out of the park, back of home plate. There's a bunch of guys who just sit there chewing toothpicks and never say a word. They're there by themselves, quietly sitting there chewing a toothpick. Sort of heavy men, very heavy, jowly, grayish sort of men who wear jackets. And they just sit back there and chew toothpicks and never say anything. Once in a while you'd hear the sound of something hitting a steel girder. And never betray a slight emotion. You hear somebody, pow, down the third baseline. This ball is drilled off the wall. They all look quietly and casually off to the left down the third baseline. And the only sign of emotion you can see is the toothpick bobs just a little quicker. And that's about it. And then they relax back into position. Just as a beautiful panorama of of the way it is. And then there was this wild moment when about 14 Mets were involved in a play where they were all on one base. And only total disaster could have been prevented by the fact that the Phils were even more inept. Any ball club that loses two ball games to the Mets is in trouble. And it's great to see. I was watching one outfielder, for example. There was a great moment. See, this outfielder's down there before the second game, and he's warming up right in front of me there. He's doing push-ups and stuff. He's moving his arms, and he's running back and forth. And he's a Phil player. You know, he looks like a greyhound. Boy, he really looks great. You mean you see those cheekbones gouged, deep eye set? Boy, he looked like he was carved out of some kind of hard metal. You know, he's running back and forth and kicking the dirt. But I kept reminding myself, remember, Shep, this is a Phil. He's the Phillies. Remember that? He kept doing these great things, you know, and he picks up the ball, and he and his fellow outfielder are whipping the ball back, these 400-foot throws, you know. They're laying them right in there. So finally the game starts. A little line drive, bounces three times. This outfielder goes to his left, scoops it up, and throws it into the dugout on a line. 700-foot throw. He goes back, kicks the dirt, looks up at the sky, notices a couple of birds, spits, walks around, slaps his glove. All right, boy, we got him there. We got him, boy. Let's go. It's such a beautiful thing to watch, this futility, this wonderful, wild futility that goes on when... And of course, you have to remember, too, that there are moments of great glory, too, where somebody really does something, where someone really, really pulls off, like there was this one moment at second base. Great moment. Second base where, I believe it was Elio Chacon, yeah. Somebody drills a hard shot right over second. Chacon dives, lands, slides through the dirt, traps the ball, picks it up, throws to second base, and there's no one covering. He turns around and looks out the center field, kicks the dirt, the ball bounces over to the pitcher's mound. Pitcher picks it up, spits, hits the rosin back a little bit, and another runner's on first. You know, this was happening all afternoon, these wild little things. And then there was another great moment. I'm not here to tell you about the base. Have you noticed that I have to say this, that there seems to be a great lack of humor on the part of the people who do the broadcast. You know, have you noticed that? There's a certain deadliness about them. I don't know why it is, but it's there. And there was another great moment, too, that I have to report. It was this runner. He's one of the Phils, you see. This is no coincidence the Phils lost 24 straight games. You know, you guys who have seen the Mets fail so badly in the beginning of the season do not understand the magnitude of failure unless you're a Philly fan. Now, seriously, do you realize that the Phillies last year, you think, come on, the Mets lost, what is it? They've won 3 out of 14 or something, or 3 out of 16 or something like that. The Mets lost 20, or the Phils lost 24 straight without winning one. Day after day after day after day. Well, this is one of the reasons. It was this little moment. See, this ball player's up there. He's again, a greyhound type. And you can see him. His eyes are hard and sharp, and he crouches over the plate. He's looking down there. And Roadblock Jones is winding up. Big Roadblock Jones. You know why he's called Roadblock? I'll tell you about that. So Roadblock Jones is kicking the dirt around. He gets his sign. He looks down. And this guy fouls one up out over first base. Fouls it off. Digs in again. He's crouching. He has gone with the whole first game, no hits, you see. And boy, you can see he's hungry. He's really leaning over the base. Really leaning over the plate there. He's digging in. Leans back in, his foot in the bucket. Here comes a pow! He drills it right into right center field. All the way. It skids out there. He tears around first. He comes sliding into second base. Wow! Oh, you have no idea what a great moment it is to get this, to really drill one out there. And an extra base hit. He's standing there. Kicks the base. Ah, boy, he's walking back. Spits. Knocks the dust off. Looks, you know, there's ball players, as is pointed out many times, are very cool. You know, it's like this is on the day's work. You know, he dusts himself off, gets up and tugs his hat down, takes a lead off of first base, off of second base. He looks back over there at the shortstop who's sneaking in behind him. Looks back again. Finally, the pitcher glances back. Jones looks back, winds up, pitches, and the guy starts right back. He goes back, darts back to second base, back and forth. He goes, that was a ball outside. Where do you think this guy's going to go? He's like steel springs, you know. It's okay. Sure enough, on the next pitch, he's off and running. He dives. Misses the bait by 4 feet. They put the tag on him. What a slide. You should have seen it. Looked like he was sliding for the pitcher's mound. They lay the tag on him, and he gets up, argues with the umpire for a moment, putting up the play, and he trots off into the dugout. Nobody says anything in the Phil's dugout. Just sits there. They're all chewing tobacco. How would you... You know, it's a funny... can you imagine anything more depressing than to be a Mets relief pitcher? Do you know anything about relief pitchers and their words? Oh, I mean, seriously. A relief pitcher, by nature, you see, is and also by profession, is concerned only with bad trouble. Which reminds me, this is WORAM and FM New York. He is concerned only with bad trouble. and it was great to watch this one relief pitcher for the Phils. He's out in center field, you see, and he walks right past where I'm sitting. He's coming in. Pitch. The Phils have committed 5 errors in 1 inning. And he comes in, and he's got his jacket hanging over his arm. He's keeping the old soup bone warm, you know. This old soup bone has not even been allowed to cool off since the second day out in spring training. You know, he's a relief pitcher for the Phils, you know. As a matter of fact, it is interesting to note that most relief pitchers for the Phils and the Mets clock a lot more time on the mound than the regular pitchers. You know that? Than the regular starters? It would be interesting to note. So he comes walking in very casually, hitches up his pants. Very cool, you know, relief pitcher for the Phils. Spits. Picks up the rosin bag. Gene Mock, the manager, is talking to him out there. Catcher's over there talking to him. He takes the ball. They toss it to him. The pitcher, who has just been knocked out by 18 errors in a row, he hitches up his pants. He spits. He walks off the mound. Disappears in the direction of the showers. So this cool relief pitcher, he's lobbing them in there. He's getting the. There it goes. You see, he's just getting the range. Pow! He's laying them in. Then he starts throwing them in more and more. Boy, he's really laying. He's a fastball pitcher. All right, he's ready to go. Stretches. Takes a deep breath. Gets his sign. Looks. Shakes off one sign. Looks over at the runner on third. Glances over to the runner on first. Lobs one over there. Runner's back safe. Looks over the dugout. See if there's anything coming from Mock. No. Spits. Looks down at the catcher. Shakes off a sign. He rears back. Off the Hutipole sign in left center field. A double. Both runs score standing up. He spits without even so much as... I mean, who could help, you know, who could help but be involved in guys like these? This doesn't happen like that out at the Yankees, you know? You can't help it. And this little guy, the fantastic disbelief on the face of the Philly pitcher, the Mets pitcher, Jackson, when he got the last out in the first game and was the first Met in history to pitch a shutout. You know, he couldn't believe it. You could just see this. And they're all running around there hitting them. It was like the end of the World Series. You know, they won this game and it was a shutout. And he sort of very cockily walks back. And then there was one beautiful moment. I'd like to tell you one lovely moment that I saw with the Mets. Just a beautiful moment. You know, I think... One of the things that I didn't even involve myself tonight to do a show on baseball, but seeing these people sitting out there back at third base with the chauffeur and the Rolls Royce and the whole thing, it just cried to be done, you know. Somebody had to say it, but I watched Roadblock Jones do something. I don't know whether he probably doesn't probably not even aware that he did this, but this is what happened. Roadblock Jones is pitching, see? And he is shelled. I mean, they start shelling him. They're really banging him around. So Jones is relieved. Well, there are few sadder sights in the eye of a man, anyone who knows anything about sports, and particularly about the Mets. You know, you don't really feel too sorry about Whitey Ford when he's being relieved, you know. After all, he won how many, 22 games last year? And he's going to win 20 again this year, and he's pitching for the Yankees, and he's at the very peak. But when you're pitching for the Mets, and you're liable to wind up with a 19-1 record, I mean, the other way around, you know, it's a little different story. So Roadblock is pitching, you see, and he starts out pretty good. Well, of course, then the roof fell in. So Roadblock's a great big guy. He turns around. They take the ball away from him. They throw it to somebody else who's going to pitch. And Roadblock, without saying a word, he just goes clunk, 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 clunk. He trots right over second base. He's heading towards the center field, you know, where they have the big do you know anything about the layout of Polo Grounds? Is in the center field is where they have the clubhouse. Now, in most other places, like the Yankee Stadium or other, they'll go into the dugout. But not so out of the Polo Grounds. When you are relieved and you're done for the day, you're not going to play anymore, it's very embarrassing because you got to go the entire length of the field, you see. Everybody sees you. So Roadblock, it's a very difficult moment, you know. This doesn't happen in people's ordinary lives, you know. It doesn't happen in the office. When, for example, Charlie flubs it, the big order from Acme, he flubbed it. So they're taking him out. They're putting in Max from the accounting department to handle the deal. Well, he doesn't have to trot through the entire cost analysis department with his head down, you know, with the papers in his hand. They just retire, and they hand the papers to Max ceremonially. They say, Max, you take over. Charlie flubbed it again. Charlie, go on down to Chockfull and let's get yourself a coffee. And so Charlie trots out through the cost accounting department, and everyone says, oh, poor Charlie, that's the third time this week. I mean, it just doesn't happen like that in life, but it happens to pitchers. So here, and remember, he's a human being, so here's Roadblock Jones. See? He turns around, he walks, runs over second base, and he sort of, you know, there's a very fine line. If you run like mad, you look like you're glad to get out of there. You see, it's somehow it's like a kid running away. If you walk too slowly, you'll have everybody in tears. You know, and the next thing you know, you're playing for Muncie, Indiana. I mean, you know. And so there's a very fine line on how the defeated have to leave the field. Well, Roadblock has it down pat. Being a Met, you know, he knows about it. So he's got it down pat. He's going off the field, cutting directly over center field, all the way out. Well, I am watching him, and here's what happened. He gets out to center field, and there's a big indentation out at the Polo Grounds. And there's a stairway that goes right up. It's very naked, you see. The stairway runs right up the side of the wall and into the clubhouse, which is about a story or two off the ground. And it's very, very naked, very apparency. So, old Roadblock, I guess everybody else is watching the pitcher who's warming up now, you see. But I'm watching Roadblock. I'm interested in this moment. So Roadblock goes trotting up the stairs, and there's about nine kids way out in center field. And he doesn't look to left or right. And the kids are hollering at him. One kid's waving a scorecard or something. Roadblock just trots right up there with great dignity. And I mean, it's hard to be dignified when your name is Roadblock. So he trots right up the steps, and he gets up to the top. And this is the sad thing. There's this door, a green door. He opens the door, see, and he steps inside the door. Well, now you would... The first thing I think, well, there he goes, you know, he's gone. No, you know what he did? He opened the door, stepped inside, he turned around then, and he stood there and looked out at the field from inside the dark there. Just looked out. He looked out, he must have looked out for about 10 beats, just looked out. And it was in the dark. The door was open, I saw him, he opened the door and he just looked out. And then he closed the door, and that was the end of Roadblock for that day. A great moment. And I'm sure the TV didn't pick this up. I mean, why would they? But it was a terrific moment. It's the kind of thing that, you know, makes you want to go out and see Roadblock again on his next time ride. And then did you read about old Early Wynn the other day? Have you been following that story? Well, Early Wynn, you see, is just he's way up in his 40s, and I think he's 42, something like that, which is ancient for a ball player, really ancient. Well, he wants to become one of six or seven, I think maybe eight pitchers, whoever won 300 games or more in the big leagues. He now stands at 293. Now, to break that 300-game mark as a pitcher is like, well, it's, you know, it's It's the final thing of a long, very illustrious career, but a very interesting one, you see. Three times before, Early Wynn was already given up as a ball player. And once he was practically sent down to the minors. Cleveland traded him and so on. And then he came back to win 22 games and become the pitcher of the year after one team had already said, you're too old, get out. And in 59, when the White Sox won the pennant, he won these 22 games and became the top man. It's like becoming suddenly the box office sensation of Broadway after you've been fired from everybody and you're down playing in the Pawtucket Players, you know? Well, anyway, this is the interesting thing about Wynn. Last year, Wynn won a game, which was in July. And something happened. He got arthritis or something, and he couldn't. That was the end of him. He was sent back to rest and to fish and everything else. He couldn't play for the rest of the season, and it looked like maybe he'd had it. So Wynn comes back this year, and he's pitching yesterday. Did you see the box score? It's a terrific drama. Wynn was pitching, you see, and he was going against Boston. Well, they ask him about it. He says, look. He says, it's all right. Don't worry about me. Don't worry about Daddy. He says, I'm going to do it. He says, don't worry about it. I feel great. That's going to work. And, of course, he's doing it entirely on guts and entirely on savvy. You know what I mean? Know-how. He knows what he's doing. He no longer has that fantastic fastball or that snapping curve. He just works every inch out there, you see. So I'm reading the box score. So Wynn is going up against the Boston team. He's going against the Boston Red Sox, which is a hard-hitting ball club, in the first game of a doubleheader. And the manager, about a month before, had made a comment, which I caught, and he said, well, I don't know. He said, I don't think we can count on Wynn this year. And, well, we've got a couple of guys coming up pretty good. So it looked like the end, you know. So Wynn yesterday goes out against Boston. And I was curious to see what would happen. This old 42-year-older trying to get... He had to have 8 victories at the beginning of this season to break the 300 mark. So Wynn pitches a 3-hitter. Beats the Boston Red Sox 2-1. I mean... And I can just see Wynn. Of course, the whole thing has to be put into its context. A 3-hitter, and they didn't get a single hit off of him after the 4th inning. This cool cookie out there, cool customer, throwing it in, and at the age of 42, you know, there's a great thing in how anybody could say, well, now this is not interesting to me. I don't know whether or not it's any more important to be a big stock market operative, or whether or not it's more important to play in the great play on Broadway. What really is more, I think almost everything we do in our life is, if you're going to analyze it, is trivial. And yet nothing is trivial. Is a guy pitching for the Red Sox doing anything less or more trivial than, say, somebody doing a great tap dance in the second act of a musical? It's pretty hard, you know, to decide. Or if somebody writes a trivial play that has nothing but a few yaks in it, is this more or less important than a well played ball game, which is just make believe, as much as the make believe of the theater, including the so called serious theater, which I think is largely make believe anyway, and the worst kind of make believe, because it pretends to be real and honest. I don't know, you know. And I'm not anti-intellectual here at all. I'm merely saying that in the end you have to come to a realization that it's all for kicks. You know? So what do all of the Socratic dialogues do in the end, you know, when we all wind up by fist fighting on the beach at Anzio after all? What difference does it make? When we will continue to do it anyway, time and time again. So I'm watching Early Wynn, and there was another thing too that happened. Was Harry Cheaty. Do you know anything about Harry Cheaty, who's another new Met out there? Harry Cheaty in his first time at bat, playing for the Mets. And of course the Mets, among all the ball teams, have an interesting collection of missed fists, sore heads, a motley collection of guys who couldn't get along with other ball clubs, one thing and another. Do you know anything about Don Zimmer? I'll tell you about Don Zimmer. I knew Don Zimmer years ago in Cincinnati when he was playing for a high school team there. And Zimmer, from the very time that he began to play baseball, he's the type of person who in any I don't care whether it's in the ad agency, whether it's in the theater, name any area of human activity, there is always one guy who is an insane beaver. I mean, who in spite of not being a great talent, is so insanely hooked on whatever it is he's doing that he's unshakable. You know, the nut in the office. who will pound on 4,000 doors, you see, where the guys with talent only have to pound on 3 to make the sales. This guy's out pounding all night, you know, on the phone, the whole bit. Well, this is Don Zimmer. And he's a real journeyman ball player, you see. But, like most guys of this insane kind of tenacity, they are prone to get kicked in the bad places. So many a guy, many a guy who has pounded on these 4,000 doors winds up being thrown down air shafts occasionally, you see, or getting kicked out of third-story windows. They can't stand them any longer. Well, Zimmer fights so much that he keeps hanging over the plate. He's so anxious to get at the ball, you know, even though when he gets at it, there isn't much he does with it. He's very anxious, so he keeps getting clouted on the top of the head. So every 3 or 4 years, poor old Zimmer has been knocked out for a year because of getting beaned. And it's fascinating to watch him play. He's like watching Mickey Rooney act. You know, he just, by sheer power, he's going to make you believe it. He'll just tear the walls down if you don't believe it. And this is the way it is with Zimmer. What am I telling you all this for? It doesn't make... Speaking of pounding doors, we have with us a commercial tonight. And I would like to recommend, if you're making a restaurant scene in New York, that you try the Mandarin House on 13th Street, between 6th and 7th, down in the Village. And don't be disturbed by all that stuff out in front of the Mandarin House. You know, they're building a gigantic new subway. Hey, where is that subway going to go? Do any of you know anything about that? There's a wild hole in the ground at the corner of 13th and 6th. Have you seen that hole in the ground? It is the most fantastic hole I have seen, believe me, since the time my pants fell apart in Michael's pub. That's another story. Did I tell you about that time? The time my pants fell apart in Michael's pub was very... I cannot explain it to this very moment. I'm sitting there in Michael's pub one day, which is this very chic ad man joint over on the east side, you know, where all the official people are, and you can hear the sound of latent phone calls going on, and there's this quiet hum in the air it's radiating love, you know, the kind of love that comes out of commercials and the kind of love that, you know, the Fashionstik produces and all that. And it's just a wonderful warm smell. You can hear the clink of ice cubes and the smell of vodka and well-aged English soul going on there. You know, oh, it's just all there. And everybody's shoulder to shoulder. Oh, incidentally, the most important of these restaurants, you'll notice, of that type, I'm talking of the Michael's Pub type, you do not sit more than, maybe 6 or 7 millimeters away from your neighbor, because that's part of it. It is the reassurance of warm bodies, all of whom which love you, on all sides of you, that is very important over there for this kind of world. You know, they're all gathered together there. It's like one big ball of wax, one gigantic promo, you know? And they're all sitting there, and it's just kind of warm. Well, I'm sitting there with this guy, and I was trying to work this deal, you know? I wanted to get... Everybody's working a deal there. And I came through and I sat down. He's sitting next to me there, and there's another guy sitting opposite us, and we're ordering the martinis on the rocks. And I put my leg out. All of a sudden, I noticed there's a gigantic hole in my knee, for crying out loud, and the pants there. So I put my knee down, and I'm sitting there, and I put the napkin over it, and I turn around, and I look. I put up the other. There's another one in my other knee. What? Crying out, what is this? And the guy is looking down at me, you know, and it's funny, I'm sort of squidgeting around, and very, there's an awful thing happened. Then this girl came over and gave us the menus, you know, and I'm flubbing around with the menus, and I said, what's the matter with my pants? And I stand up like this to go and make a phone call, and I realize the whole rear end has fallen out. And so I walked out. She says, it was a wild moment there. I walked out. See, I looked like a terrible victim of the Crimean Wars. I walked out, you know, with my head about table height. I was walking out. You ought to see me drag my... So I'm walking along there. See, and I'm waddling my famous duck waddle. And several talent scouts in the audience. I thought it was a very interesting moment. Well, I got out on the street there, and my pants were absolutely, I've never seen anything. They were in shreds, holes all over my pants. Just like that. One of the great moments of my life. By the way, the deal never worked. Oh, yes, while we're on the subject of... I'm barred from Michael's Pub. While we're on the subject of restaurants, we have with us the Mandarin House on 13th Street between 6th and 7th. And they, thank heavens, have places where you can hide when you have problems like that. You know, they got little things. You can sit there quietly. It's one of the greatest places in New York for a tryst. I can't imagine anything more intriguing than a tryst over a gigantic sea bass done with bean sauce. You know, get the thing started right. They have a bar, and it's one of the finest northern Chinese restaurants in the country, for that matter. And there it is, on 13th Street between 6th and 7th. Does anybody know about that big hole in the ground out there? And they have out in front of the Mandarin House, they have this rickshaw. A very embarrassing moment. Emily Kuo told me about this. They own this rickshaw. And how it happened was that she was visiting with a Chinese friend of hers. And she mentioned, you know, the rickshaws are very interesting. And he says, oh, yes, they are. And the next thing you know, they delivered her a rickshaw, compliments of this Chinese. And they got this awful rickshaw now out in front. She doesn't know what to do with it, and they keep getting tickets on it. She's probably the only person in New York who's ever had a rickshaw ticketed four times by the same cop for illegal parking on the sidewalk. So this is the Mandarin House on 13th between 6th and 7th. Let me see here. Oh, well, you know what difference it makes. But I would recommend if you feel that your defeat is imminent, I would suggest that you go out and see the Mets sometime. It's a kind of purgative, and as a matter of fact, I suspect this is one of the reasons why the vaguely defeated intellectuals by the millions are going out to see the Mets, because there is a wonderful sense of accomplishment when you watch defeat in action out there in front of you. It's true. Have you noticed, did you read the little article in the New York Times the other day? In fact, it was this morning, I believe, about this new development. It isn't really new, but it's becoming publicly new now. They have a new art form called, well, art form, this is a laugh, but it's a new form of something called the happening. You know what this is? Where you go and you attend this happening, and you don't know what's going to happen. It's just a happening. So you arrive, and there are seven guys, for example, dressed... dressed as paper dragons, and they fist fight. And they finally wind up by killing each other, and then you pay your dough and you leave. It's great. Or else the happening tonight will be there's a large, heavy-set girl with a mustache, and she is thrown into an enormous tub full of Karo syrup and ducked three times, and then finally thrown out the third-story window in flames. Then you leave. That's the truth. These are happenings, you see. Well, I think the same thing is drawing people to see the Mets. It's the same, yes, it is the same desire, and you notice that a happening is never any good, I derive from hearing about them and seeing a few in action, is never any good unless there is a distinct thread of sadism running through it. And also masochism is involved, too. So, I believe that after 18,000 years of winning and credit cards and everything else, somebody is looking for a real honest, the John loser. Somebody who really gets clobbered every time he sticks his head out of the ground. And we've got it. It's perfect. Believe me, if the Mets were a 500 ball club today, there would be not nearly as much excitement about them as if now that, you know, they're really... And they're, it's exciting. It's a kind of an antidote to the Yankees, too, you know. It's a funny moment. We're sitting out there watching the ball game, and they have this big scoreboard where they put up all the other scores. It says Yankees 11-2 over Washington. And you hear this little murmur in the crowd. You know, it's like the guys sitting in the Democratic convention are just notified by about whom the Republicans have just nominated. Knock it off. Who cares, you wise guy? And it goes on like that. It's a... I suppose, too, I have a feeling that many Democrats were disappointed because Kennedy won. It was such a great feeling being defeated under Eisenhower. And, in fact, I know several cartoonists that completely lost everything. It just went right out the window. Their balloons blew up and everything as soon as Eisenhower was out and Kennedy won. This has killed about five comics, as a matter of fact. And two newspapers almost went out of business overnight, who were all for Kennedy winning, you know, ostensibly. And if, you know, they look around for something. And in fact, I don't know. You know, I think this is a deep-seated thing in human nature. This may seem to be a casual discussion of the Mets, but I think it's a very deep-seated thing. The very distinct line that runs underneath all of our actions, the line of disappointment when victory seems apparent, that it's going to happen. It really is going to happen. Because almost every tycoon, for example, that suddenly reaches the pinnacle of whatever thing that he's aiming for, when you ask him, what are your best memories, he starts telling you about the old days when he was working in the shoe department. You know, the great days. He does. He never tells you, well, it was the time I was elected president, and they gave me a $500,000 bonus, and they told me that I was God. That's my great moment. Never. They always say, well, it was when I was out of work, and guys were hitting me in the eye, and I was working in the mail department. Oh, those were the wonderful days. We'd go down to Charlie's lunchroom, and we ate the sauerkraut, and I was the only guy that had a tab over Needix, and oh, it was great. This is important, you know? I don't know what would happen. Can you imagine what would happen if tomorrow morning... Can you imagine the scene? Now, lay out the scene. They decide to have a summit conference, see? Okay, big summit conference. K decides to... Have you noticed that all the tabloids call Khrushchev K? I wonder if Pravda calls Kennedy K. Or Ken, maybe. I don't know. lay out the scene, see? Can you imagine the scene here? Barry Goldwater and all the young American for freedom, everybody's all involved, you see. And finally, we get this enormous summit conference. And Kennedy arrives and Khrushchev arrives. Khrushchev's got a big smile. Kennedy's got a big smile. Advisors are on all sides of him. They sit down. The bands are playing out. The Marine band is over here, and the band of the Russian Air Force is playing over there. And they're all sitting down, and they have a big bottle of vodka, and they have a big bottle of Coke, you know, hands across the sea routine. And they're ready to go. Kennedy says, well, Mr. Khrushchev, certainly pleased to meet you. Oh, and he throws his arms around Kennedy and kisses him twice on the earlobe. And then the interpreter says, Mr. Khrushchev says, we surrender. You win. Whatever you want, we give up. Everything. Everything. Disarmament tomorrow morning. We're throwing everything in the ocean. We love you. We're all going to become Americans, and we're applying for citizenship. And could you please get me a form tonight? I want to apply for citizenship. And as a matter of fact, what I'd like to do more than anything else, I want to come and visit the A&P in Darien. And I want to buy a Ford, and it's great to be an American. My God, it's great. I know exactly what would happen. Kennedy would rise with fire in his eye and stalk out and say, we are getting nowhere.